Stone, Reverend Jim. It's true, we've practiced together for a long time in many different cities and circumstances. And someday I do want you to come to Houston. It's a very friendly community here, and it looks like you have a pretty warm and compassionate community surrounding you. I feel this is just magic that we're able to visit this way. So thank you so much. I know we have Houston and Sacramento and then Taiga-san and Koyu-san from, well, basically San Francisco and San Bruno. So this is just magic. Thank you so much for making this possible. Thank you for the interconnectedness. So I said that I wanted to talk about healing the world, which I do. But first, I'd really like to start with one of the basic, really important practices of our Zen way, which is to use the breath. You know, the breath is one of our natural allies, very powerful tool. So the more we know about the breath, the more powerful it can assist us. If you take an in-breath, this brings alertness. And as you exhale, the body knows that it can give a little relaxation. Take another in-breath. And an out-breath. Just a little bit of relaxation. And one more. One more breath of alertness. And one more exhalation of relaxation. This is part of our endowment as breathing creatures, and this happens for all creatures that breathe. The possibility of a little bit of release of tension is always there. And of course, it's possible to forget, possible to have so much stress going on that we barely can maintain. But that's one of our treasures, one of the things we can use. All of us doing this physical isolation thing now, we've been here that in order to take care of the world, we have to take care of ourselves. And we, practicing Zen as we have been, we know that that is so. We know that where we start taking care of the world is by taking care of this one. So using our breath is one of those ways, but we're going to talk about other ways to do it. Being able to stay in the middle, recognize this interconnectedness that we're watching right now is part of our true self. It reflects a mind of interconnectedness, and this mind positions us for the next steps that we're going to take. When we realize our interconnectedness, who we really are in this web of interconnectedness, we're finding our true self and healing ourselves in this relationship actively heals the world. Having the intention to heal the world, just having the intention is effective, doing what we can, because each of us is in the center of the world. Each of us is in a central position to send out healing energy. So in Houston, for the last little while, we've been studying ancestors. We wanted to take a look at the support that we're all getting from the ancestors. And our ancestors, this vast realm of bodhisattvas and Zen teachers, Zen practitioners, all those Buddhas, are surrounding us and providing us with support all the time. We're continuously surrounded by our ancestors, and we're continuously supported by them. Shakyamuni Buddha, it's the name of Buddha, practiced and is one of our ancestors, and then hundreds and hundreds of years of Indian ancestors are behind us. Then Bodhidharma in China, and hundreds of years of Chinese ancestors are behind us. Then Dogen Zenji in Japan, and hundreds of years of Japanese Zen enlightened masters are behind us. And then now, it's almost 100 years since Zen has been in the United States. So we have 100 years of American ancestors behind us. So all of this protection is handed down to us, and all of this protection is actually aimed at us. The ancestors who support us were always thinking about what was going to come after them, which is why they took it so seriously. All of it is meant directly for us. Even though they couldn't see us, they couldn't envision what we would look like, they were sending it, preparing it for us. So one of our ancestors, Dogen Zenji, the founder of Soto Zen in Japan, left us a great body of writings to encourage us. It was meant for us. It's all addressed to us. So Dogen definitely cared about the ancestors before him, and he felt responsibility for us. You can read that concern in many of the writings. He was caring for precious teachings, the mind of liberation, wrapping it all up in a beautiful language to try to send it to us. And some of it is very difficult. So I feel myself tremendous gratitude and willingness to work to decipher these messages that have been wrapped up and sent to us. The ancestors felt responsible for us, and in a way, you know, we Zen people, we have a responsibility for them. We take care of our ancestors, but we also take care of each other, and we are responsible for the generations and the descendants who are coming after us. There's a great mathematician named Frank Ramsey, and he said that it's illogical to think that we're more responsible for the generation that we live in than for the generations that are to come. We are equally responsible for the generations that are coming after us. So this sense of the ancestors behind us, all of you who've received the 16 Bodhisattva precepts have seen the chart of the ancestors, and it has kind of a linear quality. It's as if there is a mass, a pile of ancestors up above us, and then at the very bottom is our name. And I brought one, which is sort of a replica of Dogen Zenji's, just to remind you. So it looks like Shakyamuni Buddha, and then a bunch of Chinese, Japanese, and then way down here, your name. This is one way of representing where we are, and it feels very lovely to be in that the blood lineage of the ancestors, knowing that all of their teachings are flowing down to us and then flowing back up to the Buddha. It's a very nice image. But what Dogen wants us to understand is that we are in the center all the time of all this ancestral support. It's a central location. So there's another way of representing the ancestors, which Dogen wrote about. And in this one, there's a representation of the three-dimensional position that we're in with the ancestors. This is called a shisho. And this is the same document. These are all the names. And in the middle is you. So this is a two-dimensional representation. But what Dogen was trying to tell us is that this is three-dimensional. And you are in the middle of that giant orb of ancestral support. Each of us is in the center of that giant orb of ancestral support. Each of us is the center of the universe. Another way that Dogen Zenji tried to describe this to us is in his writing called 10 Directions, Jikpo, which we just recited, all Buddha's 10 directions three times. And this sense of the Buddha's being in all 10 directions can go both directions. So we're sending out our dedication after we've chanted a sutra. We say all Buddha's 10 directions three times. So the intention there when we're doing that chant is that all this merit that we've just generated together, this power that we've just built up in our chanting and in our vows, we're sending out to repay the ancestors and the Buddhas, all 10 directions, meaning everywhere, all times, all three times, past, present, and future, and Buddhas and disciples, descendants. But it's also coming the other direction. All of those Buddhas and ancestors are also aiming right at us. We're connected with them, and the link between us is alive. So Dogen Zenji really always wanted to make things clear. All of his writings, as difficult as they are attempts to clarify, but not simplify. So how can he clarify the fact that you are in the center of the universe and that your effort radiates out and heals the universe? How can he clarify that? He tries to do it by quoting Shakyamuni Buddha. So he quotes Shakyamuni Buddha saying, simply, there are Buddhas in all 10 directions throughout space and time. So Shakyamuni Buddha was trying to let us know that he really understood he's not the only Buddha. There are a lot of them. In fact, countless Buddhas in all 10 directions three times. And his teaching was for them. So Dogen takes that and says, somewhere I have this written, Dogen wants us to understand that this means, all the worlds in the 10 directions are the radiance of the self. All the worlds in the 10 directions are within the radiance of the self. So Dogen wants us to understand that being in the center of this world is where our true self lives. And then when we are our true self, willing to take that position centrally in the middle of the universe, responsible for the whole universe and receiving the energy of the whole universe, that's our true self. And the radiance of our self extends out in all 10 directions. So this is a powerful place to be. And one of the healing practices I'd like to do with you, if you're game, is a little bit of the Tonglen practice. So Tonglen practice is from our cousins in the Tibetan world, Mahayana practice. That means, Tonglen means sending and receiving. So imagine here we are in the center of our universe, center of the universe in all 10 directions. You sit in the center. And imagine what we're going to do is imagine breathing in. We're going to breathe in that alertness. Breathe in the suffering and distress of the world. Breathe in dark, heavy, hot distress of the world. And then breathe out cool, bright, weightless energy for the world. So take your place in the center. Take a breath. If you want to, you don't have to. You can just breathe. But if you'd like to try it, breathe in the distress and suffering, the hot, heavy, dark suffering. And as you breathe out cool, light, weightless, bright. Breathe in the suffering and distress, the hot, the heavy, the dark. And breathe out the light, weightless, bright clarity. This is a pretty advanced practice, but a little bit of it is very good for the world. A little bit of it sends out radiance into the world. For Dogen and for Shakyamuni Buddha, each of us is a radiant source of light. That's how they saw the world. When Dogen has, when he talks about the title of his work, Shobo Genzo, the treasury of the true Dharma eye, that's what he's talking about being able to see. The Dharma eye of Shakyamuni Buddha and awakened Dogen Zenji sees the radiance in each person. That's the true Dharma eye. Each of us has that light. All the worlds in the 10 directions are the mysterious light of the self. All the worlds in the 10 directions are within the mysterious light of the self. That's what Dogen said. What I say, it's important to know that you have this light. Your true self is this light. So Dogen Zenji, Shakyamuni Buddha, all those ancestors in a circle around us are trying to remind us of that. They gather around us to remind us that we also are that light. There's another old Zen teacher, slightly, he's a cousin to us, Yun Men. Some of you know Yun Men. He shows up very often in the Blue Cliff Record, because he had a very devoted student who made sure he was in lots of those stories. And he was a great teacher. He was great, and he also was very serious. He really wanted to pass down clarity to the future, to all of us. He wanted it to get all the way to us. So he could be quite fierce, and he was known for wielding his staff. So when we chant the universal principles of Zazen, the Fukan Zazengi, it talks about the whisk, the staff, the shout. Dogen mentions these things. So when you run into it, when he mentions the staff, he's paying respect, he's giving some respect to Yun Men. He's talking, the one who used the staff is Yun Men. So Yun Men really liked to wake people up. And one day he walked into his temple, his Zen center, and he said he liked to do this. He liked to ask questions and then answer for himself, answer for the monks. I don't know, maybe he gave them a chance, maybe he didn't, but he would often wave his staff. So he walked into his Zen center and he said, "Everyone has a light. When you look at it, you don't see it, and it's dark and dim. What is everybody's light?" And they hesitated, so he waved his staff and said, he himself answered on their behalf, "The kitchen pantry and the main gate." And then he said, "A good thing isn't as good as nothing." So Yun Men with his staff walks into the Zen center and says, "Everyone has a light. When you look at it, you don't see it, and it's dark and dim. What is everybody's light?" He himself answered, "The kitchen pantry and the main gate." So what is our light? And why when we look at it, is it dark and dim? Another way to I want to retranslate this because I get to. Another way to bring it into modern times, what is everyone's light? We could say, the dishes in the sink and the front door. Does that get a little closer to our experience? Or the clothes that need ironing and the front door. Everybody's light. Your ordinary experience is radiant light. ordinary experience is the radiant light. And being able to see this is bright, but usually when we look at it, it's dark and dim. It's just the ironing. It's the dishes in the sink. It's making lunch. And it's okay that it's dark and dim, I think. We just do our deed. When we look at it, we can't really see the radiance. When we look at it, we see our life. Other people see the radiance of our life. We often just see the light. So the interconnectedness of our experience, the fact that we're in the center of this diagram, all those people are looking at you, each of us. All energy of the 10 directions is looking this way because that's where the light is. It's not somewhere else. Your true self is the light. That's how we can heal the world, by being our true self and by understanding that everybody else also has this light. We have another ancestor, also in a slightly related, we're all related, so we have another ancestor in a very related tradition, Shantideva. Have you heard of Shantideva? Some yes, some no. Shantideva is very important, and I saw that you're studying the six paramitas. So one of Shantideva's very famous writings is organized around the six paramitas, actually. So a guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life, how to live the Bodhisattva way of life, is organized around the paramitas because they're so fundamental to the Mahayana goal of saving all beings. So Shantideva was about 400 years before Dogen. So it was still, he was still in India, but a very devoted practitioner. And I think sometime it'd be great to organize a class or a Dharma talk just on the vows, of very famous vows. Like Dogen Zenji has a very famous vow, Ehe Koso Hotsugan Mon, Dogen's vow. There are very famous vows of Samantabhadra. Buddha had some great vows. And what's flowing to us is the power of all those vows. And what flows out of us is the power of our own vows. It's a palpable force. So Shantideva made a very great vow, and I'd like to read it to you, because for me, I find it very moving. Is it okay if I read you Shantideva's vow? Just relax and think about this vow as one of the Mahayana, one of the ways enunciating our Bodhisattva vow. This is Shantideva. And by the way, this is one of the texts that His Holiness the Dalai Lama always has with him. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space endures, and for as long as sentient beings remain, so then may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. For as long as space endures, and for as long as sentient beings remain, so then may I too abide to dispel the misery of the world. This vow of Shanti Deva is part of the ancestral stream that flows to us still today and assures us that our efforts are joining with the stream and healing this world. So each of us is on the receiving end of all great immeasurable benefits. And then each of us in our central place is the source of benefit for countless, countless beings. Thank you very much. It's a joy to see you all. Reverend Jim, do we chant now, or shall we have some discussion, or?
We could have some questions. We could have some interactive discussion and questions. That would be really great, actually.
Everyone will stay muted, and you can either raise your hand like this, and then you can unmute yourself, and there are some people who are not on video, so I will also be checking the way you can raise your hand at the bottom of the managed participant screen so that I can call on you that way. Does that make sense, everybody? Okay.
I see Dave's hand.
Dave?
Yes, I was trying to unmute myself. I was pushing the wrong button. Teaching that we're in the middle of it all brought to my mind a Neil deGrasse Tyson Cosmos show I saw, I guess, a few years ago, maybe. And they explained on the show in a way I could never reconstruct in 100 years that, in terms of astrophysics, anywhere you are in the physical universe, anywhere you might be in this huge, immense universe, the way is that it's expanding, you'd find yourself smack dab in the middle of it.
It's true.
And I'm just always kind of amazed when modern physics catches up with some of the ancient spiritual teachings.
I agree. It's really remarkable, isn't it? So for thousands of years, Buddhists, including Shakyamuni and all the members of the Avatamsaka Sutra have had that view. It's amazing. So it's good that Buddhists are able to see. And how about the concept of every action, all of your small actions having an impact? Yeah, what we're carrying forward is a way of life, and it's reflected in very small activities. Our smallest activity, our subtle activity is very powerful. That's also probably Neil deGrasse Tyson gave a lecture about that, too.
Well, Larry has his hand raised.
Thank you, Reverend Godwin. I enjoyed your talk very much, and we're happy you're here. You were discussing the light. What is the light? And if I recall, you said it's in colloquial terminology, I think you said it's the dishes in the front door. And I'm wondering if that's one and the same, or if that, you know, there's different meaning to, you know, the dishes, our everyday life. I'm wondering about the front door. Is that the same thing, or is that something slightly different? I interpret it, and I don't know if I, you know, took your meaning, but when I think of a front door, I think of something that's welcoming. And when we have our first paramita of generosity, of welcoming everything, that's what occurred to me. But I was wondering what your thoughts are regarding that.
I think that's lovely. I think that's really good. Because in the koan, the words are the front gate. So Yunmen said the front gate. And you know, in a Chinese and a Japanese temple, the gate is one of the major buildings. It's welcoming, it's inviting, it's a big statement. So I think that's a lovely interpretation. And also, the radiance, I want to say, the word that is used in the Lotus Sutra and also in Dogen's writings, Chipo, Ten Directions, is komyo, which means, it's translated in most of the texts as radiance, but the literal characters are mysterious light. So it's not just radiance simple, it's mysterious light. Thank you.
Thank you.
So Jim, Aaron had his hand raised.
Yeah, the challenging thing still after all these years is to hold goodwill for things that I'm averse to, like the barking dog and the squirrel that's knocking the unripe plums off the tree.
Oh, sad.
Yeah. So, you know, I know when I'm practicing deeply, it's a little different, but still, you know, this aversion comes up and it's really hard to, like, generate. It's a very radical move to generate goodwill for those things. Any further hints on that?
Yes. Well, being human is always a challenge. It's always going to be a challenge. It isn't about having a special state. So to be, and you know this, I know, but I'll just say it. To be your true self isn't one flavor. Your true self is the whole universe of responses and reactions. And so to always have one flavor wouldn't be true, because we will act appropriately. So we will act appropriately. We'll see worse things than squirrels knocking unripe plums off, you know. We'll see worse things, and we have to respond appropriately. But we act from the center, and we act with, we act appropriately. I started to say various things, like we act with dignity and clarity and so on, but we take action. Buddhism, here's one of the phrases in Nishijima, Buddhism is a religion of action. So being in the middle doesn't mean stasis, doesn't mean only one feeling, it means experiment and creativity right there in the middle of the dynamo. So do you have a lot of paper bags? Because you can bag the plums. That's what we have to do to the peaches here in Texas.
I actually, this year I cut down my apple tree because after so many years of trying to protect the apples, I just decided that the kind thing actually to do for myself was just cut the tree down. It wasn't maybe so kind for the tree, but it actually brought quite a bit of relief to just not, you know, just to take away that, that place of pain. But of course we can't always do that, right? You know, so So that's kind of a simplistic solution. And I know that the real solution is in the mind.
Yeah, well, the real solution is shared. The real solution is we share it. There is no single person solution, you know. So the real solution is to share it with our friends and talk about it and let other people help us carry all of this. That's what we need to. I think part of the problem in our world is thinking that each of us has to solve it all by ourselves, and then it's just not true. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
So Millard has his hand raised. Millard?
I would prefer to be the last to speak because what I have to say is minor and kind of a joke.
Well, please tell the joke now. We like jokes.
If you insist. Have you seen the Mount Methuselah Baptist Church Zoom meeting, anyone, by any chance?
Not I.
So it's different from our meeting here, but you can enjoy it after we all disperse on YouTube. It's Saturday Night Live, the Mount Methuselah Baptist Church Zoom meeting.
Thank you. I will look for that.
It will has his hand raised.
Will.
Thank you. That was a beautifully inspiring talk, and appreciate it.
Thank
and the Shakti, the Shanti Deva vow, something I plan to incorporate. I don't know if you can hear me.
It's me, but I can hear you.
My question, in Reverend Jim's introduction, he mentioned that there was trials in Houston. I was wondering if you could share what you might have been referring to.
I think he meant the floods. We've had two major floods in the last few years. And is that what you're talking about? And I was driving a Red Cross truck and going and rescuing people and things. Yeah. Yeah. So we've had floods. We've had drought. It's a very extreme climate area. So. And now, in 2008, there was a, no, it was in the 1980s. 2008, there was a minor, what do you call it? Depression, or what do you call an economic catastrophe?
Recession,
thank you. But in the 1980s, there was a severe recession because of the collapse of oil prices, and that's kind of the mood in Houston now. So in the 1980s, people had large mortgages, and they just walked away from their mortgages, leaving all of these abandoned neighborhoods. And since for the last 20 years, Houston has been incredibly prosperous. 80,000 people a year move to Houston. But now it looks like suddenly the world is turning around. So it's going to be a very interesting time to continue to live in Houston. That's what he was referring to. When I first moved to Houston, I don't know, have any of you ever lived in the South? Great. My family is from the South, but I had never lived here. And so I had some strange, now I see them as strange ideas, but I took a serious self-defense class in San Francisco because I thought people would be toting guns or something. And Houston is a very liberal city. There's, you know, no problem. But why was I saying that? I can't remember. Anyway, when I moved to, I had ideas about Houston that have since changed, but the climate challenges will never go away. It will get more and more extreme now.
So Oscar has his hand raised. Oscar?
Thank you, Jordan. Thank you, Reverend Godwin. And Thank you, Jim. I wanted to add my own squirrel confession. I'm moved by Jim's sorry, very sad story. Well, some years ago, my neighbors planted podocarpus along the fence line, and I don't know if you know podocarpus. It makes a great hedge. But they didn't treat it as a hedge, so it's now about 60 feet tall. I mean, there's a whole line of them along the whole property line, and they're thick foliage that it's not a deciduous tree, it's always there. And about 2 years after they planted the tree, my plum, apple, and Asian pear tree stopped having enough bounty for both me and the squirrels. And it's been that way for about 12 years now. I rarely, once in a while, I get one piece of fruit, but of course the squirrels always get them the day before I would pick them. And I pretty much gave up. The fruit trees are decorative now, and I can't say that I'm fond of the squirrels. I have called them perverts and worse, but once in a while I will feel a sense of empathy and sympathetic joy when I see one enjoying itself. So if you can't beat them, join them, I guess is the conclusion that I came to. I urge my neighbors, and to conclude, I urge my neighbors to call Smud and have their tree trimmed because it's very close to the high tension they need. And the Smud came and it cut the trees way down, and I'm sure, so I'm hoping this year I may get some fruit. So there is hope. Thank you very much.
Hey, Homa.
Who did you call on, Dorley?
Homa. Homa, you have to unmute yourself.
Okay. So my question is, when you were guiding us through our breath, or you were suggesting for us to breathe in the darkness and the weight and the heaviness, which I do practice that, I noticed in my out breath, whatever I was breathing in, it was also coming out. But then when you were reciting the vows, and I was listening to the vows itself, the vows as I was breathing in those vows, the same vows were coming out.
Oh, lovely.
Yes, it was so clear, so clear. And I cannot speak any more than just receiving and being and just the flow for that to be. My question is more where I usually, it happens a lot, is when you call the dishes and, you know, the activities, the heaviness, I understand what you are speaking. I understand it intellectually, mentally, and there had been times that I breathe in the weight and heaviness and ask for compassion, and through compassion, as soon as I'm in touch with that compassion, then it changes its form of darkness into light. Mm. most of the time, the majority of the time, as I'm breathing dark, it comes out dark. So I am asking the question or the request of more deeper connection or deeper guidance, so that when I breathe in the dark, I can easily release that light and let the light be.
That is a really good question, Palma. That's a very, very important question. And breathing in that dark requires wisdom. So wisdom is what enables us to titrate or calibrate how much we're breathing in. Wisdom either that we have already developed, so we know today is not a day I should be doing that practice. That's kind of wisdom. Or wisdom, you check it out with your friends, you know, you talk with Jim, you talk with your spiritual Dharma friends. Very important to use your Dharma friends and to help have your friends help you moderate that. So without wisdom, we can try to do too much. You know, we might do too little, or we might try to do too much, but wisdom is what tells us the right balance. So there's a koan about that, you know, swallow the Western Ocean in a single gulp, which is a message to a very, what would you call it, eager Zen monk. You can't swallow the Western Ocean in a single gulp. But we can breathe in a little bit and breathe out just a little bit. And that itself, that's enough. It's the accumulation of all of our efforts that makes this tremendous dynamo so effective. Okay?
I know there's some message, something needs to come in, and that's not there yet. And once, and I know every time I express myself, it comes. You know, it may not come right in this moment, but it always, always comes. So I will let that be, even if it feels not 100%, but I let that be also.
Excellent. Good. Thank you. Thank you for that.
So I had a question. I appreciated your using the word very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
At this, like, every moment of our lives practice, being fully present and offering our lives, the impact is very subtle. And I guess that says to me it's fully an act of faith, really, because we don't know. It's sort of a question.
True, we don't know. And in our Zen world, that's the very intimate place to be, not knowing. So trying to be of service in our lives in a subtle way, the most accurate way to be is to not know. To make our best effort, to make the effort appropriate for right now, and we don't really know knowing what's needed, we really often miss the mark. So we go in with beginner's mind. We go in wondering. And also just the feeling of wanting to be of help is so refreshing for people. So just the feeling, it's good for you and it's good for everybody. And then people can use you as they need to use you. I hope that sounds okay.
You. Thank you.
I think that's what Shanti Deva's message is, that he wants all of these things. He wants naked people to have clothes. He wants diseases to end. He wants these things. This is the subtle power of our effort. We want these things, and then we do what we can, you know, with our very small human capabilities. We're like squirrels, you know. We're just doing the best we can. Karen, I see Karen over here.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to thank you for bringing Shanti Deva into the conversation. For the last month, I felt like he was sort of calling me to come back to that book. And I think you just confirmed it for me. When I first started getting interested in Buddhism many years ago, I heard the Dalai Lama speak about him briefly, and he concluded his talk with the last verse that you read in the vow about, as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, so too may I remain. And I've never forgotten it. And so I read the book at that point, and very enthusiastically. But, you know, I didn't take much away from it except that it seemed very sweet. I was kind of interested, but I didn't know what to do with it. And I'm really feeling like I want to go back to it now. And you're inspired in that, too.
Good. Well, and when you go back to it, Karen, I think you're going to see that it's I don't know if sweet is the word I would use for it.
Yeah.
Sweet is kind of a takeaway, but the way he talks about anger, the way he talks about transformation, some of the passages are really quite hard. You know?
There were some very difficult things, and the language, is somewhat, I would say archaic, for lack of a better word, but there was a lot about hells and, you know, hellfire, too.
Right.
So I'm interested to see how it comes in this time.
Right. Well, archaic, as you say, and again, they were writing in their time, trying to get these messages out to us. So they used the language that was available at the time, some of the concepts, some of the cultural references of the time, and we have the opportunity to be very understanding about that. Some of it is archaic. So there might be trigger warnings necessary in some of the books, but remember, just as you see, you know, remember the intention. What the intention? The intention is to serve us.
I think there were some things about women that, at the time, were distressing. And
yeah. There are some things about women that are distressing. It's true.
Thank you.
I should go get my copy and cut some of those pages out. I no longer need it.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm not sure, Jim, do you have your hand raised?
I just wanted to say something that kind of is a coincidence, is that, you know, you brought up our connection to the ancestors, I don't know since when, but for quite a long time in our study group, we've been reading the Denko Roku, or Record of Transmission of the Light. And it just so happens that this week we're getting to the chapter on Dogen, and on Thursday we'll be reaching the end of our reading of that work. And I really recommend it to people, although it is, I think, really benefits from being read in a study group or where there can be discussion and so forth. But I also want to mention that we really benefited from, I doubt you, maybe you had something to do with this, but anyway, we just benefited from so much from the Soto Shu new translation of that work, and we were reading Cook's translation, but Mm-hmm. We had the Soto Shoe online, at least up to a point, and it was so helpful to read the two, you know, in tandem, and, you know, get the perspective of two different translations. So I just want to thank our guests from Soto Shoe International for that, for making that available to us in English, and a new translation by some very competent and well-studied, you know, translators. And I wondered if you could tell us maybe a little bit, Galen, about your, what does it mean to be the director of this Soto Zen International group?
Well, first, I want to say that thank you for bringing up the Soto Zen Translation Project, because that really is a very important offering that's being just given to us by Chimucho headquarters, Soto Zen headquarters, and sometimes people forget that, you know, our ancestors in India are selfless, our ancestors in China are selfless, our ancestors in Japan have that same selflessness. They're just trying to give us as much as they can of this these teachings of your true self, you are in the middle. And so that effort to translate Shobo Genzo and Denko Roku, and there's another translation of the rules, the Gyoji Kihan, all the ceremonial things, and those are all available for us. And yes, our international center had a lot to do with that, although before I was director. And Taiga-san, he's very important. He's available to you for everything you want. And also Koyu-san, I think, is she still here? Or did she go off with her baby? Can't hear you, Taiga-san.
Actually, Koyu, Wi-Fi cut down.
Bad Wi-Fi.
No family calls about the soul fan. You bought the still my Wi-Fi is down. No, it's okay. Yes, go on, please.
Okay. So, was that clear?
I couldn't understand that.
His Wi-Fi, there's big problems with his Wi-Fi.
Yeah, but my Wi-Fi system has down. And, yeah. Now it's okay. Yep.
Now it's better. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
You want to say again?
Yeah. I had that from our another office called North American office. And Jim Thorne-san, you bought the Denko Roku from them, right?
Yeah. I haven't.
But you're using the online.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm using the online, but it doesn't have all the chapters online, so I sent away for the book, but I haven't. I'm hoping to. Yeah, it will come soon, but haven't received it yet. But looking forward to having the book.
The my colleague Kojima-san, Doukan-san, told me he will send soon.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Let's see, Oscar, did you have your hand raised again, or I'm not sure.
Yes, thank you. Reverend Godwin, I was interested in your comment that Buddhism is a religion of action.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, and I'm not sure, but I'm wondering if there's a connection between that view and the concept of, and Dogen's concept of practice realization. I hadn't made that connection before myself, actually, but Would you care to comment on that?
That's a great connection, Oscar. That's really, that is at the heart of it. And that was Dogen's original question. So you could say that was his koan. If we're all already at the center, that teaching that we're all already at the center of the universe, why do we need to do anything? Well, we're at the center of the universe, and everything we do has an impact. So all we are is action. And then being aware of that and feeling appropriate, feeling responsible for that is when your practice really starts to cook. Not stepping aside from being at the center and not turning away from the consequences of all of our actions is when your practice is really cooking.
The nature of wind penetrates everywhere.
Yes, but we're going to keep fanning. Thank you. Great question.
Thank
Part
you.
Of the reason that Buddhism, I'll just say one more thing about Buddhism being a religion of action, is that this is it. Here we are. We aren't trying to get somewhere else. This is it. And it's got a mysterious light.
Can I make another observation about that? So we recently heard another Dharma talk, a wonderful Dharma talk. And in that context, action was... one of the modes of action that was referenced was social action, let me say. There is a feeling among some people nowadays with the many problems that the world is facing that there is a certain, I wouldn't say, well, a movement or a reason to become socially engaged. And to do that in a Buddhist context. And I wonder if Houston is, if there's any movement such as that in Houston, or any discussion of the role of Buddhism in expressing the Bodhisattva way through social action.
Yeah, that's a very important question also. And we, as Jim and I were talking about, we, when there was a flood and people have asked, you know, how many people were affected by the Hurricane Harvey in Houston a few years ago? How many people were affected in Houston, a town of 6 million people? 100% of the people in Houston were affected. So we all were helping all the time. I think we're all active, pretty much, but we don't call it social engagement because that seems to have a certain agenda, and we kind of haven't felt the need to call ourselves socially engaged Buddhists, but we've done various people, and we're very diverse in terms of political views here in Houston. So there's a certain kind of respect that is called forth because of that. And so there are people in our group who've gone down to the border to witness the treatment of the immigrants coming across at the El Paso border. I myself have gone down to, I've done a lot of things, and I myself have gone to the places where they're putting children, separated children from their parents. Those are just humane issues. They have, for me, those are outside of politics. Those are just helping people. Mm-hmm. Anything like that, it's easy. You can't help but get active. Mm-hmm. But we don't try to do things as a sangha, as our definition of our nature as a sangha. I guess it comes back to what we were talking about earlier with Homa. We have to use our wisdom to decide when and how each of us acts. And then we all can feel the support and the respect for the kind of action that each of us chooses. I think it's subtle. It's super subtle. Social engagement should be subtle because it's so powerful.
And there can be a tension, too, between not holding on to fixed views and not being attached to results and wanting myself or working, having as, I don't know how to say it, wishing that something would be improved.
Absolutely. There is a tension. And we also, all of us have to guard against, and I'm as, you know, active in the world of, and I'm as active as a person can be, pretty much. And when I go in there thinking that I'm right, it's problematic. So I go in wanting to help, wanting to put my energy, use my life energy to end suffering. But I don't go in thinking, I mean, it's a problem if I go in thinking, I'm right, I know what should be done next. So I think Dharma friends need to help each other with that particular dilemma. It takes courage to tell your friends, well, I'm not sure if you're right. It takes real courage.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Homa, is your hand up now?
Okay, I just unmuted. So basically, when you were speaking of Buddhism as an action, what I'm hearing is you're speaking wisdom and proper response. Is that correct?
Yes. And we're always responding.
I think I react I react. So therefore, from what I understand, is when you're being at the center, you only respond, you only act, which is pure wisdom.
I hope so. But, you know, it's a dynamo, and everything we do is a response to the situation. We're never not in the center. We forget that we're not in the center. I mean, that we're in the center. But we're always in the center. We're always responding. And we're always calling. So we're always calling. We're always being called. We're always responding. The Buddhas are always responding to us. So there's that line in the Samadhi, you know, response to the inquiring impulse. So the Buddhas are always responding to our calls.
Yes, but then I'm asking for your own personal experience being in the world and being active.
Uh-huh.
Do you, is there a sense of freedom in your practice? In your actions?
Of course. We always are free. We always are free. I mean, we get to look at, we study the self. There's that famous phrase, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. So we're always studying it, but we're always free. All of our actions are a choice. There, we get to watch what drives them. You know, there it is, driving me. But the action I take is a free choice.
I wish to see that, be that for myself. I'm not there, but that is my wish for
you
me.
You will see it. You will see it. That's part of, you know, the value of this breath work that we do, you know, being able to take a breath and notice that there's a pause right there, you can see the freedom. Mm. And you can see, okay, here I am. I'm going to do my habit response. I'm getting irritated at this thing, or I'm afraid of this thing, or I don't want to, or I'm sure I'm right. That's one of my main habits. I really like to be right. Somebody at Tassajara, Maya at Tassajara, pointed that out to me. Galen, you really like to be right. So me talking about not going in with a sense that I'm right is a major step forward for me. It's a major achievement for me. So we're all always growing. I thank all the Buddhas all the time for having more time to keep growing. Just keep witnessing this miracle unfold of the true self. So, I don't know, it's not, we don't need to be terribly judgmental of ourselves. In that fascicle, Jipo, in the 10 directions, Dogen, first he praises Shakyamuni Buddha for saying that, referring to all the Buddhas in the 10 directions. But then he says, and the one thing that Shakyamuni Buddha wasn't doing was criticizing any of those other Buddhas. And it's actually pretty remarkable. So the commentator, Carl Bielefeld, says that he thinks that Dogen wrote that because people around him in Japan were saying that Amida Buddha was better than Shakyamuni Buddha. And so Dogen wrote that Shakyamuni Buddha didn't criticize other Buddhas. And it's true. He never criticized other Buddhas. And he never criticized himself. He never said, oh, I'm not good enough. I'm not as good as those other Buddhas. He was in the center, working with the tools he had. So each of us has unique and subtle tools to work with. And if we compare each other, that Dogen said, Shakyamuni Buddha didn't sit around comparing the Buddhas. They all had different skills. Some were women, some were men, some were this, some were that. They all had different skills. All of us have different skills. And each of us has different skills at different times in our life. So it's not that, you know, we're getting better. We're just changing and using our skills differently. That right?
Beautiful, and we're deeply grateful for your wisdom and your encouragement, and I think maybe now we'll come together for our end of lecture chant. Oscar. And then we'll have announcements.